I've been doing these military veteran interviews now for over 25 years, and it has been a tremendous blessing to me to have this great opportunity. Our next story is an Air Force veteran telling us about his years fighting in Vietnam as a Doppler inertia and radar technician, about his part in the Tet Offensive in 1968 and his bout with Agent Orange, which still affects him today. Here is retired Staff Sergeant B.J. Field.
I'm a native-born Texan. I grew up in the Dallas area. I went to college, and I received a draft notice in June of 1965. And in August, I went down to the Air Force recruiter and asked to sign up. And the Air Force recruiter took me upstairs to the Selective Service Bureau, got my information, and I took the battery of tests, had physical, was sent to Lackland Air Force Base, small amount of basic training, and then I got orders for a school. And my school was 52 weeks long. It was aircraft radar and inertial navigation, which was a highly technical school at the time. I learned radar and went to Dyess Air Force Base after school on B-52s. I was a Doppler radar and radar altimeter technician. When I signed up, I had no idea. I did not have an option to choose anything. I just went in and took whatever they offered. And due to the fact that my brain had a little bit of knowledge in it, they gave me a very technical school, and I went through it real easily. Electronics has been very simple for me to understand. And so, therefore, when I went to the radar school, F-4 Phantoms were just coming into play. They came out in the early 60s, and their navigation system had an inertial nav system. It was a gyroscope. And after I was there for about 6 months, I volunteered for Vietnam. And it takes a while for all the paperwork to go through, so it wasn't until August of 67 that I got notice that I was going to Mountain Home Air Force Base in Idaho to learn side-looking radar on the RF-4C. And then I got orders for Vietnam, and I was stationed at Tan Sanut, which is right outside of Saigon. And when I got there at 67, and it was very comfortable in the beginning, except for rockets going off and being fired by the enemy and small arms fire and B-52 bombs not far away. You can tell when a B-52 is bombing because what you hear is a distant rumbling, like the hundreds of bombs that are going off at one time. The Tet Offensive of 1968 started in the early part of 68. What happened at the same hour in the morning, every station that had any United States service members was attacked all over the country, every one of them. It was a coordinated offensive by the North Vietnamese, Viet Cong, to disrupt and attack everywhere, everything. So that was a wake-up. Our base, in the process, was overrun. We were sent to our duty stations and issued M-16s, and we fired across the runway. And it lasted for about 10 days, so it was kind of a mess. Our base ran out of food because the runways were closed. We were issued sea rations, which I'd never eaten before. When it was over and we went to somewhat normalcy, we were still getting rocket attacks at night. A very good friend of mine was in a hangar on the second floor, and he walked to the top of the stairs, and a rocket hit the entrance to our hangar, and shrapnel separated his head from his body. So that was a very tough situation for me to go through. And that's the only person that was close to me that I dealt with while I was in Vietnam. Throughout my time in country, I saw thousands of dead Americans because I was at Tan Son Nhut, which is a major base. And every single day, there would be two or three C-141s, and they would load up flag-draped coffins. So I saw that every single day, a somber plight, a holy ground, as you might say. But I saw that every single day, so that really got into my brain heavily throughout the whole time. Since I had been there for so long, when August of 69 came around, I'd been in country for like 22 months, my first sergeant came to me and said, "You've been here a long time. Nixon wants to get rid of some people. Would you like to be discharged early?" And I said, yes, I will. I was a technician and a line chief on RF-4Cs. So I would debrief a pilot that came in, download the equipment, and send it to a correlator. Correlator would come out with black and white film, and people could look at boat traffic up and down Vietnam. Our pilots would hit the air and they'd head south, come along the Mekong Delta on the ocean side. We want to see the traffic on the ocean and which tributaries boats go up. Most of our pilots flew at night or in bad weather. Radar doesn't care if it's light or dark. Radar doesn't care if it's raining or not. So a photographic reconnaissance plane could not photograph in cloudy weather. Yeah. They couldn't photograph at night. So that's where the RF-4C came in real handy with that side-looking radar because it was a mapping radar. It was made by Goodyear Aerospace. And we nicknamed it Rubber Radar because it was Goodyear Aerospace. You know, the blimps, the SR-71 was a reconnaissance. So reconnaissance is a big portion of the military. My deal was a side-looking radar that was a mapping device. It would take a picture of the land, the rivers, and the ocean to pick up boat traffic.
And then BJ told me something that I had not heard before.
How did you get to Agent Orange?
Agent Orange is a chemical, and it's sprayed like a fine mist. And that stuff would get in the air, and people had been dying of stuff, and the government fought it and fought it and fought it for years. When I came back from Vietnam in August of 69, by November, December, I had gone to the VA to claim problems. And when I was evaluated at the VA hospital, they told me that, well, you probably had that before you went in. So I was denied. So I never went back until about 15 years ago when people were saying, well, you need to go. They've changed a lot of that. Well, when I went, they asked me where I was stationed. I said, Vietnam. And the lady at the information desk said, oh, you need to go around to the Agent Orange section. So I went around there, and within 6 months, I had gotten 90% disability. And when I came down with Agent Orange cancer, I was bumped to 100%. I call my legs my combat injury because I have problems with my legs due to Agent Orange. When I got out of service, came back to Dallas, I went to Texas Instruments and applied for a job. When I came back, my boss said, would you go to Vietnam? And I said, yeah. And I wound up taking a top secret weapon system to Vietnam, the laser guided bomb. At the time, it was top secret. I stayed in the military industrial complex for a period of 8 years, the military and then TI.
At the end of our interview, I asked BJ if he prayed much when he was in Vietnam for God to keep him alive. He told me this.
I knew there was a God, but I never went to church. Since there was every kind of drug you can imagine over in Vietnam, whatever, you know, all of it, I chose alcohol. Alcohol was my drug. And I came home as an alcoholic, and I spent 15 years fighting that devil, and I did it with the help of God.
My thanks to BJ for his service to our country and for being a true patriot. BJ Field is now fully retired and very active in his work for the Lord, and he tells everyone about Jesus. I'm taking a break now. Another interview will follow after these messages. On this Memorial Day, we remember the great men and women who served our country and those still serving today to keep us safe and free. This day is more than just time off work or picnics or parades, shopping for the big sales, all good things, but they cause us to get off track as to why we have this special day. Memorial Day is a day to remember and honor those who gave us the right to be free. To get a copy of this Memorial Day program, a tribute to our heroes, you can visit our website at www.jerrystewartusa.com. And if you subscribe, you will get a free download of this program airing all across our great nation. Now, our website is a great way to spend quality time together as a family and learn the history of America. And on this program, you will hear the stories as told by the men and women who were there. Visit www.jerrystewartusa.com and subscribe to get your free download of a tribute to our heroes. Or you can call us at 817-995-4607 to find out more. God bless you, and let's keep moving forward with our prayers, with our concerns over the safety and the way our country is walking, and let us be praying for our president and all of our other leaders, that each of them will come to know that it is God who is our leader. We thank you, Lord. God bless you.
And now this from Northern Michigan RV.
Hi, I'm Tony Kessering from Northern Michigan RV in Galen. Get ready for a new adventure with help from Northern Michigan RV. We sell everything from pop-ups and truck campers to luxury fifth wheels, and we have everything to keep you going, including parts, full service, and even propane. And we're open year-round. Don't buy anywhere before stopping into Northern Michigan RV. Off 32 on Expressway Court behind Walgreens and Gaylord. Online at northernmichiganrv.com. Get ready for a new adventure at Northern Michigan RV.
At Royal Tire in Petoskey, we know that you've got things to do and places to go. And you need safe and reliable tires that will get you there and back every time. Tires like the Michelin Defender LTX or the Michelin Cross Climate 2. We believe in these tires so much, we put them on our own vehicles. So stop by Royal Tire today and let our tire experts find the right Michelin tire to keep you and your family safe. When you think tires, think Royal Tire in Petoskey.
Life is a wonderful journey, from fresh beginnings and future adventures to all the best life has to offer. Along this incredible journey, you want to safeguard what's most important to you. Hi, I'm Tristan Cole, your local Farm Bureau insurance agent, and I'm always nearby to help protect you and your loved ones along the way. Let's talk about your journey and protecting what matters most. Call me at 231-533-6489 or visit me online at TristanCole.com. We're Farm Bureau Insurance, Michigan's insurance company.
Antrim County Conservative Union's 6th Annual Fun Shoot and Pig Roast, Saturday, July 19th from noon till 4 p.m. in Central Lake, Michigan. Come join us. Bring your firearms and ammo as the safety gun ranges will be open. They will be serving an iron pig smoked pulled pork dinner with all the fixings, including Trucker Randy's world-famous carrot cake. Check out all the details and make a donation for your tickets at their website, acconservatives.org, or call 231-420-8320. See you there!
Hi, this is Ian Murphy from the Iron Pig Smokehouse in downtown Gaylord. Join me every Tuesday at 10 a.m. with Trucker Randy for an update on all things happening at the Iron Pig. We're open 7 days a week and serving breakfast Saturdays and Sundays. You can order online anytime for takeout, curbside, and delivery at ironpigsmoke.com. And be sure to keep up with our legal battle against the health department by subscribing to our podcast at fuelcasttv.com.
Gun owners in northern Michigan don't have to go far to get their firearm problem solved. Curtis Gunsmithing handles all gun work, adjustments, bluing, rebarreling, cleaning, and even FFL transfers. Need a stock refinished or some custom work done? How about a trigger job? That's right. Let the gun doctor, Tom Curtis of Curtis Gunsmithing, take care of old Betsy. She'll be in good hands. Call 231-347-3487. That's 347-3487. Curtis Gunsmithing of Petoskey.
In the long and honored history of America, there are names that shine like beacons in the night. The patriots whose vision gave us meaning, who kept the lamp of freedom burning bright. In the long and honored history of America, there are those who paid the last and final price. Who were called upon by chance or desperate circumstance to make the ultimate sacrifice.
Hello, I'm Jerry Stewart. Welcome back to this special Memorial Day program. In World War II, while the Allies were busy fighting fierce battles in Europe, equally fierce battles were being fought in the Pacific. But in the Pacific, Allied forces were fighting a different kind of soldier, the Japanese. And early in the war, the Japanese soldier built a reputation for being unmerciful and unwilling to surrender, even if it meant certain death. In fact, their very religion taught them that a good soldier would fight to his death and that surrender meant disgrace. If they were forced to choose, many Japanese soldiers would kill themselves before giving up. This made them a foe that could only be defeated by death. In August of 1942, the Japanese Empire had reached its height. They controlled a majority of islands stretching halfway across the Pacific. They seemed to be invincible. Allied leaders determined that the only way to break the Japanese hold was by a tactic called island hopping. They would attack certain key islands while passing others by. But this idea of hitting the Japanese straight on, landing a beach, and then fighting to secure a hold on the island was very hard and costly. In fact, many an American soldier would die before he even reached land. It would take a particular kind of soldier to fight this war, men who were specially trained to fight Japan's best. These special men were found in the Marines where groups called raiders were formed. These raiders were trained in all areas of war and killing. They were taught the martial arts and hand-to-hand combat, and only a very few were chosen. One of these chosen was Joe. This interview was the first time that Joe spoke publicly about his war experience, and so he asked me just to use his first name, Joe. In 1942, when the Japanese were winning the war, Joe was still in high school in Kansas. But as the war heated up, young men began to sign up for the draft. And one day, the Marine Draft Office received quite a surprise.
The whole football team that I played on back in Kansas, we decided we'd all go and join the Marine Corps at the same time.
But of all the boys who signed up for the Marines that day, only two were taken, and Joe was one of these. One of the big reasons was that Joe had already received some special training in his school.
They got a person to come in that was a black belt in jiu-jitsu, and he started teaching jiu-jitsu in high school, and several of us boys took it.
After learning jiu-jitsu, he went on to judo and karate and taekwondo. So when Joe joined the Marines, he was a perfect candidate to be a raider. He was assigned to the 1st Marine Division and became a part of Carlson's Raiders, named after its leader.
Colonel Carlson was one rough person, and he taught us hard. He used every bit of natural abilities that we had.
Joe and the 1st Marine Division jumped from island to island. Their job was to secure a beach and hold it. Joe learned early that his martial arts training would save his life.
When I met a man face to face in over in the South Pacific, we were too close to use any weapons. Couldn't even pull your knife. And so we went right into hand-to-hand combat. He was a real large man. I'm here.
Joe was hesitant to talk about many of his battles, but he was there at Guadalcanal, Iwo Jima. He was able to talk with me about one attack on the island of Pialu. As 700 Marines and 7 landing crafts prepared to attack, Joe can still remember.
Before the gate dropped on the landing craft, you could hear the Japanese bullets hitting the plank. It was a steel, it was just probably 3/4 or a 1/2 inch thick steel. And you could hear, it just sounded like, oh, it's terrible.
Then, once the gate dropped, the men had to wade, sometimes swim to shore while being shot at. And many never made it.
Once you hit the beach, you went up the beach as fast as you possibly could to the first place you could get cover.
That day at Pialu, the Marines were taking a terrible beating. The Japanese army was well fortified. They had machine guns up on the cliffs firing down on the Marines, and men were dying. Somebody had to stop those guns.
See, I got up underneath the cliff as much as I could, and I took a hand grenade and I threw it up in him. They threw it back before it went off. And I remember pulling the pin on the second one, and I held it in my hand and threw it. And it went into the... It went into the nest. Right at my feet, there, one of the Japanese hit the beach flat out, blown to pieces.
Joe couldn't say any more. He said it was just too horrible. But here is the account of what one captain saw as he landed on the beach after it was secured. He said, "The human wreckage I saw was a grim and tragic sight. Wounded and dying men were everywhere. As I ran up the beach, I saw them lying nearly shoulder to shoulder. I saw a ghastly mixture of bandages, bloody and mutilated skin. Men gritting their teeth, groaning and writhing in their agonies. Men outstretched or twisted or grotesquely transfixed in death, with entrails exposed or whole chunks of body ripped out of them. Then the captain saw a friend lying flat on his face, his head riddled with bullets and his arms pointed toward a pillbox where 5 dead Japanese slumped over a machine gun. One can only imagine the horror. The Allies went on to take the Pialu Islands and continue their fight, but at a great cost of lives. And Joe told me one last thing. He said, when the atom bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, and then 3 days later another on Nagasaki, the Allies were already planning their single largest attack, their most dangerous mission of all, to hit the beaches of Japan. He told me the atomic bomb saved tens, perhaps hundreds of thousands of American soldiers' lives. And Joe is certain he was one of these. A final word to Joe. Thank you for sharing your story. And thank you for your brave and courageous service.